Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
In 2022, Team Milk came together by sponsoring female marathon runners for the marathon in New York City. Today, they're more than 20,000 strong. In 2024, Team Milk is making an even bigger commitment to female runners and launching the only women's marathon in the U.S., designed for and by women. The inaugural Every Woman's Marathon will take place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16, 2024. You can learn more and register for the marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
Hey, it's Max, and we're back with the next interview in our series this week with this year's George Polk Award winners. Today, I'm talking to Mariba Knight. She's a reporter with Nashville Public Radio, and she won the Polk Award this year for her podcast, The Kids of Rutherford County. Produced in collaboration with Serial and ProPublica, The Kids of Rutherford County is a four-part series that went into great depth, telling the story of a really, like a truly shocking approach to juvenile discipline in a Tennessee county. So for years on end, a single elected judge implemented this system in which hundreds and hundreds of kids were arrested and detained, many of them for minor offenses, some of them just for witnessing a fight, all in direct violation of state law. And as you'll hear, Mariba used the pandemic to jumpstart her reporting on this story, reporting that went on for years. It began as a print piece and evolved into the podcast. And her work, in many ways, had a huge impact. The program came under national scrutiny. The judge retired. The county paid millions in settlements. But also, not as much changed as you might think. And Mariba and I talked about that tension, about how it feels to have your work make an impact while knowing that much of the system that allowed such brazen injustice is still in place. So here's my conversation with Mariba Knight about her Polk Award-winning podcast, The Kids of Rutherford County. And we'll be back tomorrow with another in this series of conversations with winners of the George Polk Awards. Hi, Mariba.
Hey, Max.
Thanks so much for doing the show, and congratulations on your Polk Award.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here.
I feel like at some point you'll have to come back and we will have a sort of full long-form podcast interview, because your career is fascinating to me. You have bounced around a bunch of different places. You have found a way to do work in cities and at venues that at least I, in my, you know, provincial haughtiness, don't associate with it. And I'm interested in how you do all that. But we are here for a specific reason, which is to talk about your podcast, The Kids of Rutherford County. And to start, if you don't mind, can you give me the quick version?
Sure. Yeah. Well, this is a story about one county in Tennessee, about 30 miles south of Nashville, whose juvenile court was essentially running amok of the law, federal and state law, for decades. And what they were doing was illegally jailing children and wrongfully arresting them. It was essentially kind of a mass incarceration scheme that was all under one juvenile judge who had been there for a very long time, and the jailer that she appointed, and the court that she oversaw. So it's really a story of how absolute power kind of corrupts absolutely, and then the complicity of all of those people in that system who made it, you know, chug along.
The product of that corruption and that failure is shocking. I mean, it's an incredible number of very young kids jailed for things that are not crimes.
Yes.
It's extreme in every direction.
Yeah. The age of the kids, like as young as 7 years old, the alleged crimes that the kids committed. You know, the story really opens with this big scene of 11 children getting arrested for watching a fight. And not
watching a fight.
Yeah. And not stopping it. So they charge them with this very vague charge called criminal responsibility, which turns out to not even be a real charge. So that's just like, you know, red flag number one is they're charging kids with crimes that are not even real crimes.
And also, not only is that not a real crime, but all of us would be guilty of it all the time if it were.
Right.
Preposterous.
Right. And even one of the young girls, Amaria, who says in the video, it's all based on a video that goes on YouTube, as many things start with children these days. It started on YouTube. And this one little girl is saying, stop, stop. And yet she's still arrested, even though she is trying to stop the fight.
Literally just trying to break up the fight.
Mm-hmm.
How'd you find the story?
Yeah, it was a really slow burn. You know, first and foremost, I'm a local reporter. And so I live here in Nashville. I report in this area. And I had moved here from Chicago in 2016. And I was kind of immersing myself in the area. And the arrests of these children happened a month after I got here. I had reported in Chicago on gun violence, on neighborhoods, on racial issues. So I was like, what is going on? Like, how are these children being arrested and for what? And so it kind of stuck in my craw, but I kept moving along and reporting other stuff. But essentially, like, all of them filed lawsuits. And so those were the breadcrumbs. And so this question of, like, what is going on in this county? Like, how did this happen? Like any good investigation or any story, really, it starts with a question. And that question just kind of never went away for me. And then I met one of the lawyers who was on one of these big cases. And I started to look through the filings. And I noticed that, like, these two lawyers and then this third one were on a ton of lawsuits. So there's like 7 lawsuits surrounding this county. And I started poking around and I'm like, these 3 lawyers are on like most of these lawsuits. Like, what's the deal? And essentially, as I followed like the breadcrumbs of the lawsuits that turned into this big 2 class action suits, but one that we kind of focus on in the story, which is over these arrests and these jailings, one of the plaintiffs in that was one of these kids that was arrested in that mass arrest. And so to me as a storyteller, I was like, oh, it's all connected. Okay. And so that's really, I just started pulling the thread. And the thread was like hundreds of filings, 7 lawsuits. And when you looked through his lawsuits, you saw the mechanism that was underneath. And so, you know, every reporter needs a good lawyer. Like, they all, you know, lawyers are great sources. But essentially, I started to kind of pay attention to this story in 2016, but I didn't start fully reporting it until 2020. I covered it a little bit in 2017. I gathered more documents, but like any kind of local beat reporter, I was like, when am I going to get to this?
Mm-hmm.
And I had other projects. And then when I finally did, because it was honestly a great pandemic story, there was so much paper, like before
right.
I could start interviewing, there was just so much paper. And so I started pulling the thread on it.
You just spent your quarantine like FOIAing documents?
Yes. Yes. The whole first episode I FOIAed, the tape that we use, I FOIAed during quarantine. And I had plenty of paper to push during quarantine. And really, actually, just like a week after I got my vaccine, I was like, I'm off and running. I'm going to go interview these people. So, yeah, it was
wow.
It was a slow burn.
That was your first step, huh?
Yeah.
Post-vaccine was get out and start reporting the thing?
Yeah. Talk to the kids. Yeah.
You mentioned that you had just moved from Chicago when you first encountered the story, do you think not knowing the area was an asset in reporting it? Was it a liability? How did being new to the area interact with reporting a story of this scope, particularly when this sort of injustice at the heart of it is so shocking?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, first of all, I'd never lived in the South. I'm from Boston. I went to school in New York. Like, I'm a total carpetbagger. So I came here and was like, I have to understand kind of what I'm dealing with. Like, where am I? And in some ways, like, I think my freshness did help in kind of my outrage. Like, I don't expect this to be happening. This never happened in this way in Chicago on an individual kind of one by one basis, but a big arrest, mass arrest like this of kids. I think that I had trepidations initially of trying to figure out the answer to that question because I was so new. But by the time I really started to dig in, I felt very acquainted with the area. And I felt very educated about the history. Like, we don't talk about it in this story per se, but like this whole neighborhood that these kids were arrested in, it's essentially the fields of a plantation. Like, these apartments, these affordable housing complexes, like, they are on the land that was the fields of the slave owners. So to me, like, there was a lot of work that had to go into me understanding these communities before I was going in, because this is not like when I was in Boston or when I was in Chicago, the history doesn't go back that far. So I did pay a lot of attention and I did read a lot of history, and that underpins all the reporting, even though it's not like showcased in there. But I think it was both. Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about Judge Davenport, who is at the center of the story.
Yeah. Judge Davenport is one of the more fascinating characters. I hate to use that term, but because she is a person, but that I've encountered. I mean, I don't usually like to have stories with true villains because I don't really think anybody's a true villain. She definitely comes across sort of as a true villain.
She's pretty close.
However, like, she's also a product of her time and her place. She's a white woman from the South who grew up in a time, a boomer, when the hierarchies were different, where the way we treated children was different. And the way we treated children that were different from us was extreme, right? And she is someone who I found to be one of these people that kind of failed up. Like, she found her way. So essentially, Judge Davenport is from this small town that actually is right near me called Mount Juliet. She goes to junior college in South Carolina, a Christian junior college. She gets married young, she divorces, and she decides that she wants to become a lawyer. So she goes to night school, becomes a kind of family attorney. She struggles. It takes her 5 times to pass the bar. And eventually she passes the bar and she does some family law, some divorce law in Rutherford County where this takes place. And essentially she's there at the right time, you know, right place, right time. They had never had a juvenile court before. This is in 98. The county is starting to grow and they have these kind of junior judges, which are called like referees. And they essentially just like do the juvenile cases kind of a la carte. And they appoint her to be a referee in 1998. And then essentially because the county's growing and also the General Sessions judge hates juvenile court and doesn't want to deal with it, he's like, we need to start our own juvenile court. And so they started in earnest and she runs against someone in the sheriff's office, which proves to be a very big rivalry going forward. But she wins with like 8,000 votes. But that is her foothold, right? That is, and what's interesting, not to get too off, but she initially runs as an independent, then she runs as a Democrat, then she runs as a Republican. So it also kind of, the arc of like our country's politics is shown in this too. But she runs, she gets elected, and she just remains. Every 8 years, she runs again, unopposed. She's very powerful. And a big part of this series is using her radio show. So she didn't talk to me. But we were given a gift from the reporting gods in the fact
from the archival tape gods?
Yes, in the fact that she has, or she had, up until I reported this story, a radio show that she went on every month for a decade on the local radio station, WGNS, the Good Neighbor Station, which is Rutherford County's local commercial radio. And she got to talk about her work. And essentially what she was doing with that was it was her propaganda machine. She got to go on every month, talk about the great work she was doing and project this image of the court. Meanwhile, she was completely overreaching in all these other ways, telling law enforcement when to arrest kids, setting all these policies, you know, essentially flouting the law and saying, it doesn't matter. I'm in charge. This is my courtroom. And all the while, you know, the people going through her courtroom, some of the lawyers are like, what is going on? However, on the outside, the image she's projecting to the community is, I am the only judge you'll ever need. And I am the greatest judge you have ever had. In fact, like, she was voted the favorite elected official in the local Ruthies, which is like the local, you know, People's Choice Awards for the county. Mm-hmm. So she just had an immense amount of power, and she just kept amassing it. And she, just to return to kind of the question, like, who is she? I mean, she's somebody that got to build a system from the ground up. She got to get in there at the ground level of this juvenile court, and she got to build it in her image. And that included literally building a new jail for kids that she lobbied for, that they built bigger than they were advised to build it. They built it more secure than they were advised to build it. And it really is a story about a cult of personality around this woman to say, like, statistics, experts, science be damned, we have our own way of dealing with kids, and we will deal with them in that way.
Yeah. One of the things that's really striking in the show that I found surprising was the degree to which these are choices. They're choices made by one person that then had a system propping up those choices. But it's not like the juvenile justice system in Rutherford County is exactly like the one next door. It's like every county is able to determine how they want to do it. It's like everyone's making it up. And so you can have progressive politics next to Davenport, you know, jailing kids for standing next to a fight.
Yeah. I mean, that is kind of the real big background of this story, is that judges have a huge amount of discretion, generally. Judges in juvenile court have even more discretion, because juveniles in Tennessee don't have a right to a trial. The judge is the judge and the jury. They don't have a right to bail. Like, there's all of these things that are employed by adult court to kind of give you some sense of autonomy, even though they're imperfect, and objectivity and a fair shake, but you don't have those in juvenile court. And then you also in juvenile court have these different rules, because the whole, like, mission of it, as was set out in the beginning of juvenile court, you know, by Jane Addams in Chicago at the turn of the century, was we need to rehabilitate kids. Kids have the ability to be rehabilitated. So don't punish them. Look towards rehabilitation. And so because that's the mission of juvenile court, the fact is that a lot of people do things that are the opposite, but they're not really questioned, because it's just expected and talked about so frequently that they almost forget that that's not what they're doing, you know, like it's and so, and also, yes, there is this real unevenness around the courts, and also because they're private, right? So a big obstacle in this type of story is that juvenile court is essentially a black box. The records are sealed. Most of the court proceedings are sealed. The lawyers cannot talk about their clients. You can't get the determinations of these cases, let alone kind of the filings or anything. And so that's supposed to protect the child, right? It's supposed to say, we will give you privacy so that this doesn't follow you the rest of your life. But on the flip side of that, it gives the adults in the room immense amounts of power, and nobody is watching. Nobody can hold them accountable. And so what was so critical to a story like this was having these federal lawsuits, was having a higher court looking at this and having these lawyers, bless their hearts, filing more filings than they need to file with the hopes that someone like me would come along and be like, oh my gosh. So once I started to pick through all the federal lawsuits, it was like the door got cracked open and I could see into this system that otherwise I would never see into because I don't have subpoena power. I can't file for discovery. Like I can't do any of that stuff. And so that's why it was so critical to have the federal court involved in the first place, because that's where I got all of my records. Because even the lawyers who are featured in this, they couldn't talk to me about these cases.
Why do you think no one had found this before you?
I don't think the mechanisms were set up to see it easily. I don't think... Listen, it's 2024. I got out of J school in 2008. The bottom was falling out. The local paper in this county has one reporter. It's also a story of local news, right? Of nobody having the time to dig in. People taking the word of the judge, the word of the police officers, not having the time to ask questions. I mean, this was a huge story in the county. The fact that it went for years without anybody digging in, it is kind of stunning. However, like the lawyers were working diligently, but one of the main characters in this guy, Wes Clark. And this is also one of the reasons I loved this story, because I saw these two lawyers, Wes Clark and Mark Downton, who were lawyers in her court, who cut their teeth in her court. And then Wes comes and bites the hand that feeds him. Mark bites the hand that feeds him. They do what no lawyer is compelled, set up, or pushed to do, which is to go to your essentially employer and say, you are messing up. You are breaking the law. I am going to sue you, essentially, like, and they do.
Right. They could have made a whole living and career off trying cases in her court, and instead they took her to court.
Yeah, exactly.
There is something haunting about the story, or at least the experience of first reading it in ProPublica and then listening to it on the show. And I do want to talk to you a little bit about that jump in medium, but there is something haunting listening to it because it is so stark. So we were talking about at the beginning, like the injustice is so clear and absurd. And the fact that not only had it not been reported upon, but she was going on the radio and bragging about it, makes you think about how many stories like this there must be out there that simply don't get someone like you who has the time, the resources, the energy, the ability to dig in the way they need to.
Absolutely. I mean, this is why, like, I started this out being like, I am a local reporter because I believe that local reporting is so critical. And I moved here. I'm not a native. However, I send my kid to public school. I pay taxes. I live here. I care about the people. And when I go out and I see the stories that are just coming at me like a fire hose, it's hard. I mean, it's hard to choose, you know, it's because this was 3 years in the making. Like, I have to be judicious about what I choose. But the fact is that there's so much that's happening in the darkness. And these small towns, I mean, listen, Rutherford County is a growing county. It's a very fast growing county, but it still acts like a small town. And they insulate themselves. They protect themselves. They close ranks around themselves. I mean, we can talk later about how difficult it was to get people on the record who worked at the jail, who worked at the sheriff's office, because there is so much retaliation that happens for speaking about these types of things. And for people that live and work and are going to probably die in that county, it is not worth it for them, you know? And so it is really hard to get into these stories, and there's so many of them. And it's all the more reason why I really love reporting in the South, because it does feel like there is not enough of us, but there's such a saturation of stories, and they're so rich in history and place and politics. And they really kind of, you know, I'm just going to take a, you know, my mentor is a guy named Alex Kotlowitz, who has been just an unbelievable force in my life. And I'll never forget, like, when I first read his book, There Are No Children Here, he talked about going to Chicago and kind of feeling like it was the perfect place to peer into the heart of America. And I would say I feel that way right now about working in the mm-hmm. South. It is a really amazing and profound and a little scary perch, but a really, really good one to peer in the heart of this country. So I love working here. I think it's important.
Let's talk a little bit about the process of reporting this story. So it started as a, I wanted to say print, but I guess it's not print. It started as a text article. A text article on the internet that you did with Ken Armstrong mm-hmm. and ProPublica. And that piece is quite straightforward. Mm-hmm. Like a very fact-based, this is the story of what has happened in this county. And I'm interested in how you went from there to a four-part narrative podcast.
Yeah. So, you know, ProPublica is a pretty kind of straight-laced, inverted pyramid type of news operation. We did push this a little by making it a narrative. And of course, that's my first love and what Ken Armstrong is so good at. And Ken came on to this actually a bit late. I was part of this local news network that ProPublica does called the Local Reporting Network, which is so great. And it's so important, again, talking about local news and infusing it. They have this whole program that really is single-handedly like churning out amazing stories from localities. But he came on because he was just so fascinated by this story, and there was just so much lifting to do that he was like, could I be a part of it? And I was like, yeah. When you get Ken Armstrong being like, can I get to be a part of it? You say yes, you know, to the firepower of Ken Armstrong. But so then, yeah, we essentially decided, you know, this was going to be a story that was narrative, but it was going to pretty much be straight, follow the kind of lawsuits and target these two individuals, which at that point, talking about kind of accountability, the judge was still the judge and about to run for reelection, and the jailer mm-hmm. is still the jailer. So here you have these two key people that have 7 federal lawsuits aimed at them, millions of dollars in settlements, and they are still in their jobs being paid by taxpayers. So
just going to work.
Just
every
going
day.
To work every day. So from an accountability standpoint, you know, it was a really important story. And so we did a pretty straight-laced, yeah, narrative of that. However, like in reporting that narrative, I got to know the attorneys on the case really well, and I became more and more enamored with their arc and the work that they had done, particularly with this guy, Wes Clark,
yeah.
who he himself was a juvenile delinquent, quote unquote, and he came in there as a recovering opioid addict, alcoholic, to the court, I mean, and essentially, the reason why he ended up in juvenile court, which is why a lot of lawyers end up there, is because they can't get another job. He had a DUI. He had drug arrests on his record. He, you know, almost didn't get his law license, even though, like, passed the bar, did all that stuff. But his character and fitness was kind of, like, hung up because of these. And eventually he did, and he knew he wasn't going to get a job with a white shoe law firm. So someone tells him, go to Rutherford County. There's tons of work. Because tons right. of kids are being arrested there. And so he does. And he's just kind of like this guy with a chip on his shoulder who was one of these kids. And he walks in and he's just like, hold on. Like, the emperor has no clothes. Like, what the fuck is happening here? Like, you're not following
the
law.
It wasn't just like, what the fuck is happening here? Yeah, it's like, this is a statute.
Yeah, like there's a statute that
you... This whole system is in violation of a thing that is written down.
Yeah. You asked, like, how does this happen? One of the things that we played with thematically in this show was these two realities. The reality outside the court that Wes has, the reality of the law, and then the reality inside the court, which was Judge Davenport's reality. And mm-hmm. that was flouting the law. And, you know, these two things are in such tension with one another. And we, you know, you wonder, like, well, who's going to win? Like, which reality will prevail? And so I wanted to turn it into a podcast I knew immediately. One, because there was really good audio. When we talked about, like, FOIAing during COVID, like, I got all of the audio of the investigation for the kids who were arrested, those 11 kids that were mm-hmm. arrested. Nobody had ever asked for that audio, so I was the only one who had it. I listened to it. It's 38 hours. I'm like, oh, my God, this is wild. And so mm-hmm. I had that audio. I had these depositions from the judge and the jailer. I had the radio show. We had 70 hours almost of Judge Davenport on the radio. And then I had these kind of goofy lawyers. And I just felt like this really is kind of made for audio. And it's mm-hmm. got these fascinating characters that are all kind of these imperfect heroes, you know, who go up. I mean, essentially, it's a David and Goliath story, right? It's like you got these small town, like, juvenile court lawyers getting paid nothing that are like, you know what? I think we're going to go up against this big, massive system called Rutherford County and mm-hmm. with no experience. Like, he got there right out of law school. He's like 26 years old. But he had the conviction and he had the kind of anger built up in him to say, like, I am going to burn this place to the ground. Literally were his words. Yeah. And so, yeah, I just got fascinated with that. Now, I will say, I would not advise usually doing a podcast after a print piece. I mean, the amount of times the door was shut in my face, like, the cat was out of the bag. Everybody knew what I was doing.
Right. And the print piece had a pretty significant impact. I mean, it caught.
Yeah. It kind of went, like, viral. This, like, tweet thread that we did was, like, went all over the place. And, you know, like, Dan Rather tweeted about it and, like, Nicole Hannah Jones. And, like, it was because it was so shocking, right?
Right. It's just so stark.
But then, you know, you go to the county folks, you go to, like, the detention officers or other attorneys, and they're just like, oh, hell no. I'm not talking to you.
You couldn't quite play dumb at that point.
I could not play dumb. Like, I knocked on so many doors and I was like, hello. And they're just like, no. Like, literally, I got one guy that was like, hell, like, I will never talk to you. Click. Like, so many of those. So, you know, yeah, I couldn't play dumb. I couldn't act like I'm just on a fact-finding mission. I had a lot of my findings already. What I was now trying to do was go re-report it in a way that was worthy of Serial, right? Worthy of this kind of not just we're going to do acts and tracks. We're going to have a real character-driven kind of personal arc evolution story. And I spent about 6 months trying to get county people to talk to me on the record, and it was just brutal. It was the hardest thing I have done in reporting, and it was really demoralizing and frustrating. But in the end, it was okay because we had what we needed from depositions and from mm-hmm. background conversations. But yeah, people were scared. They were like, no, I just need to get to my pension. And a lot of people were scared of, you know, the connections that, like, the jailer's husband is a detective in another county. Like, you know, there's just mm-hmm. so much. It's all kind of incestuous. And, like, there's so much flack that can come back on people for talking.
I don't want to spoil things, but you did get one county official.
Yes,
to talk to you.
I did. I got some. I got more than that. We didn't use all the tape, but I did get, yes, Jeff Phillips. I got him to talk to me. That was a really difficult and interesting interview.
If the people who said no to you needed validation for that choice, listening to Jeff Phillips might have helped.
Yeah. But at the same time, so many people wouldn't talk to me. But then the ones who did, I was just so stunned by the lack of reflection. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are many people in that county still out there that think that this whole story is just ridiculous. And, you know, there's this moment in that conversation with Phillips where I ask him, he tells me, you know, I'm not going to point fingers. I'm not going to, like, I ask him, do you think it was Duke? Do you think it was Davenport? Like, who do you see as responsible for this? Because somebody is responsible. Because the fact of the matter is that thousands of children were jailed illegally and more were wrongfully arrested.
It's also not, like, up for interpretation. Like, it was ruled on in a court.
Like a federal
judge.
They
had an $11 million settlement.
Yeah, like a federal judge was like, you have violated the U.S. Constitution, and also, by the way, you violated state law. But when he said to me, I'm not going to point fingers, and I said, why? And he said, because there are some dedicated public servants whose reputations could be ruined. And I just thought, you're going to say that now, after all of these kids have been treated this way. You're going to decide to extend grace to these adults who are in charge and should have known better. I'm still mad about that. I will forever be mad about that. But the double standard that they have about protecting those dedicated public servants and letting the children that they traumatized just kind of languish, it hasn't registered, at least not with the people that I spoke with.
It does seem like your reporting on this, while it maybe has not registered with Jeff Phillips, has registered a great deal with the structures that were in place. A lot has changed, and a lot has changed because of the reporting, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, the judge eventually decided not to run for re-election, and they set up a oversight board for the jail, although my reporting of that is really that it's pretty toothless. They gave hiring and firing power of the director to them, and I surely was like, well, the first thing they're going to do is, like, get rid of Lynn Duke, the jailer, right? Because she's the one who implemented the most problematic policy. It was under Davenport, and Davenport okayed it, but Lynn Duke was the one who came up with this filter system that was deemed unconstitutional by a federal judge. And I thought, well, surely, like, she's going to go. No, she's still the jailer. She's still the jailer.
She's still the jailer. And the jail is still doing big business.
It is doing big business. I mean, when we looked at the numbers, that was really interesting because this is also irrefutable. Like, when the filter system in 2017, and I covered this in like a 2-minute radio spot, the federal judge issued an injunction stopping this policy that I was just talking about, the filter system, and essentially saying, like, this is very problematic. We have to stop doing it until this case is determined. And at the end of the case, they ended up, you know, making that injunction permanent, but he issued a temporary injunction. And so what you got to see over the, you know, 4 years that had passed since I started really digging in was you got to see the numbers just plummet. So you could see the impact. Like, it dropped by over 80% the number of kids that were ending up jailed. However, their revenue started to surge. And when I looked at why the revenue was surging, it was because they were taking kids from other counties. And so what they did essentially was they built a jail that was too large. And a while ago, they decided, well, if we can bring kids from other counties who don't have jails, then we can make a little revenue off of them. And they just began to have to rely on that more and more and more. And so you saw kids coming from other counties. And when I dug into that, I saw there were kids that were being jailed illegally too from other judges and other counties. And Rutherford County is now benefiting from that illegal decision. It's like whack-a-mole.
It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. And it did make me wonder what your sort of, I was going to say conclusion, but that's not even right. Like, I wonder where your sense of closure or resolution or, like, where this all left you. Because it's like, again, I mean, I've said it a couple of times. It's just like, it's so stark. And the injustice, the illegality of what was done was so clearly documented, so successfully argued in court. And yet, of the $11 million that the county was supposed to pay out, I think it's what, 23%?
Yeah, like they they paid the lawyers too. So they ended up paying like $5.1 million, but most of that was lawyers' fees.
Most of that goes to the lawyers. The jailer is still in business. Davenport still has her pension. And the jail is full of kids.
Not only that, I don't want to get really dark, but I've been covering the state legislature for another project, which is a whole other ball of wax. However, I've been watching these bills get introduced. And there's some really terrible juvenile bills. There's a bill that was introduced to be able to hold kids accused of minor offenses longer than the federal law allows, which was at the heart of our story. So I do this reporting, I put it out there, and then a state lawmaker says, I think I'm going to file a bill so we can hold kids longer.
Let's double down.
Or another bill of transferring kids as young as 15 for theft of a firearm. I mean, I...
Where does that leave you? Because I found that speech you gave earlier about reporting in the South and how important it is inspiring and moving. And I wonder how you square that motivation and energy with the results of a reporting project that in many ways feels like it went as well as it could have.
Right. Impact was made. I think it depends on the day. Like, I think there's more work to be done, but I just think about the long game. You know, I think about that there is a long arc to justice, and that the more I can figure out stories that in some way, shape, or form are a continuation of this work of, you know, I won't be back in Rutherford County, but being, you know, at the state legislature, I'm looking now more about like laws that are set and why are they set and who's lobbying for them. And so I think that there is an arc to this work as well that is slow and methodical, and you have to celebrate your wins. You have to celebrate the impact. You can't go in being like, I am going to make X impact. That's not the type of reporter I am. Like, I'm going in there to tell a story. Like, I am obsessed with stories. And so making a story is also fulfilling. You know, the creative aspect of crafting and telling a story fills me up too. And then I'm kind of hungry for the next one. So I feel like, where does it leave me? It leaves me with a searing anger that is going to propel me to the next thing. That's what it's doing. But we've made some real improvement, you know, and that's worth celebrating. Like, that's worth recognizing and saying, like, this work matters. People are paying attention. And maybe there's some regressive lawmakers who want to go back to the 90s and think every kid's a super predator. Now, maybe those bills won't survive. Like, maybe they won't pass. So then we'll be okay. But it's, you know, I don't know. To borrow a phrase from Obama, it's like, it zigs and zags, right? But I love this work too much. I love being a local reporter. I love getting incredibly close to my subjects. And I love telling stories that are compelling that, like, you can't look away from. And that curiosity continues to drive me.
Zinging and zagging, I can wrap my head around that. And I will say, really, like, because of what you were saying earlier about how important it feels to be where you are doing the kind of work that you are doing, how happy I am both that you're getting this recognition for it and also that you got the energy to keep doing it, because it seems pretty important to me too.
Well, that's all we can do, is keep putting one foot in front of the other and trying to make the world a little bit better and tell some cool stories while we're at it.
Mary Beth, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you so much, Max. It's been really amazing.
Thanks for listening to Longform. I'm Max Linsky. Our editor on this episode was Gabriella Saldivia. Thanks to her. Thanks to Mariba for her time. And thanks to John Darton and everyone over at the Polk Awards for making this series possible. We'll be back with a new episode tomorrow.
Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Cope Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.